Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
My most memorable pork tenderloin ever was at a filling station, of all places, in Knobbone, Indiana. And there was just something about biting into that exceptional sandwich in a gas station that just made it a great experience.
That's breaded pork tenderloin sandwich expert Rick Garrett. The folks of Traditional Arts Indiana speak with him about what makes this dish so very Hoosier. Then we spend a good chunk of time getting our hands dirty with a group of fourth graders in the gardens, both on top of and around the Middleway House. And Chef Daniel Orr brings us two recipes, one for Caribbean-inspired grilled chicken and another for a summer berry grunt. Stay with us. Mia Partlow is here with our news for the week. What's up in the world of food, Mia?
Well, the Farm Bill is making news again, as it is now up for consideration in the Senate. Foodie activists took the opportunity to make their voices heard this week by sending an open letter to every member of Congress describing just how lousy they think this version of the Farm Bill is. They're against proposed cuts to the SNAP program, they oppose continued subsidies to commodity crop growers, and they are concerned that small farmers aren't receiving enough federal support. The letter ends by saying, quote, "When it is your turn to vote, we urge you to stand up for local and healthy food and nutrition programs and to support equitable and fiscally responsible amendments that will protect and enhance public health and the environment while maintaining a reasonable safety net for the farmers who grow our food," unquote. Among the 72 signers were chefs Mario Batali and Alice Waters and authors Michael Pollan and Wendell Berry. In bad news for Monsanto this week, a new report from the Union of Concerned Scientists claims its Drought Guard corn variety isn't all it's cracked up to be. According to the findings, the new hybrid does not exhibit improved water use efficiency, which is a measure of how much water a plant consumes in relation to its yield. In response, Karen Batra, spokeswoman for the Biotechnology Industry Organization, says that it's too early to make assumptions about drought-tolerant technology. And the Walt Disney Company has decided to stop carrying junk food ads aimed at children, making it the first company of its kind to do so. The parameters require cereals to be under 10 grams of sugar per serving, and food served to children at Disney theme parks will contain 25% less sodium. Disney is likely to lose current sponsors in the move. There is even more going on in the world of food. Get additional news updates by visiting us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for Earth Eats.
And go to our website as well, eartheats.org. Mia Partlow, always a pleasure.
See you next week.
For many Midwesterners, wind is an occasional nuisance. For farmers, though, the wind's impact can be huge, drying out crops and eroding topsoil. Gusts big and small also complicate the application of chemicals, and that can be particularly costly. Reporting for Harvest Public Media, Perry Stoner takes us inside a new research facility in North Platte, Nebraska, where researchers are throwing their unique brand of caution to the wind.
As an electric engine revs up, Greg Kruger, a crop systems specialist with the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, explains the setup.
We have an axial flow fan, and that creates an air flow. And then we've got an air straightener. And then we've got a laser system, and we've set up a single nozzle sprayer inside this 4-foot by 4-foot wind tunnel.
The sprayer sends water through the tunnel. Kruger and his team are trying out dozens of nozzles, searching for the most efficient and effective chemical application methods. It starts with the droplet size coming out of the nozzle.
We know that the smaller the droplet size, the greater the drift potential. Those small droplets take longer to reach the ground. So anytime we've got an airflow that's pushing those droplets, if it takes longer to get to the ground, it's going to move farther from the point where it was released.
Chemicals are designed to keep crop diseases and pests in check. The researchers want to know how much pressure is ideal for application. More force usually means smaller droplet size.
So there's a sweet spot in there where we're trying to hit so that we don't have a lot of drift, but yet we're still getting the control from that pesticide that we want.
The research is right on target for Kevin Wemhoff. He owns Vantage AgriService in Odo County in southeast Nebraska. Applying liquid chemicals makes up a large part of the business, especially this time of year. It's windy this time of year, too, and chemical application directions don't allow for much wind.
Technically, by most labels, it's 10 mile an hour. Oh. And obviously, there are many, many days in Nebraska that's over 10 mile an hour.
Wim Hof's high crop sprayer looks like a large transformer toy as the boom unfolds to a span of 90 feet. Onboard sonar, which sends a signal to the ground to measure its distance, automatically adjusts the height of the boom for optimum efficiency. While technology and information have improved efficiency, Wim Hof says it's still important to continue to get better.
With more acreages, where we're relatively close to some urban areas, Lincoln, Omaha, some other places, there are more vineyards, there are more acreage people, there are more people that moved out of town that you need to be very sensitive to. So you're always looking for more data, more information on how far particles move to give you the best idea of how to handle a field.
That's what Greg Krueger hopes will come from the research at the new wind tunnel facility in North Platte. In addition to the machine that blows at 15 miles per hour, a much larger machine can be attached. It creates winds up to 200 miles per hour to replicate aerial chemical spraying.
We've got engineering meets physics meets biology.
After some initial testing, Krueger will put plants in the wind tunnel for further research. He hopes the work will help establish standards for drift reduction technology. DRT is something the Environmental Protection Agency is already focusing on.
This DRT policy will have labeling on products so that applicators, when they pick up a nozzle or they pick up a drift-reducing adjuvant off the shelf to use with their application, they'll know that that product will have the ability to reduce drift.
The wind tunnel in North Platte is only the second of its kind in the U.S. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Perry Stoner.
The breaded pork tenderloin sandwich is a dish indispensable to Indiana taste buds. It's generally accepted to have been invented at Nick's Kitchen in Huntington, Indiana, but Iowa has also staked a claim to the title of home of the tenderloin. Betsy Shepard of Traditional Arts Indiana's Second Servings takes a closer look at this Midwestern staple.
Any Hoosier menu that doesn't include the breaded pork tenderloin sandwich has a mammoth hole in it. The breaded pork tenderloin, which often spans the size of the plate on which it's served, is a mainstay in Indiana cuisine. According to Rick Garrett, the breaded pork tenderloin connoisseur who has been featured on the Food Network, Indiana identity is defined, in part, by this celebrated staple.
Like the Indianapolis 500 and all the IU championships are certain things that people relate with Indiana. And I think the breaded tenderloin is one of those.
Why the breaded pork tenderloin? And why Indiana? To understand that, you have to understand its origins.
The story that I have got is that the family that owned the original restaurant was a German family. And there is a German dish called schnitzel, which is basically a breaded veal cutlet. In Indiana, in the 1920s and 30s, veal was not a real common commodity, but pork was. So he thought, I wonder what would happen if I bred this, and a legend was born.
Rick's love for breaded pork has taken him all over the Midwest in search of the perfect sandwich. And according to Rick, the best breaded pork tenderloin sandwich is found in one of the unlikeliest of places.
My most memorable pork tenderloin ever was at a filling station, of all places, in Knobbone, Indiana. And there was just something about biting into that exceptional sandwich in a gas station that just made it a great experience.
If that description wasn't enticing enough, then for the love of adventure and all things pork, my coworker James and I decided to take a pilgrimage to Knobbone to see for ourselves what people were hailing as Indiana's holy grail of breaded meat. So how did we find the off-the-grid joint Rick was talking about? Roger Sharp, the owner of Nomart, made it easy for us.
That's why on my sign it says home of the original Knobbone tenderloin, because I am the originator of this tenderloin.
Roger was tight-lipped about some of his specialty ingredients, but ever the gracious host and breaded pork promoter, Roger gave us a tour of Nomart and walked us through the step-by-step process of sandwich making. First, he soaks them in a marinade.
This is what they look like after they've been in my marinade. I take them out and drain them. the drier they are, still want them tacky, the breading sticks to them good, and it doesn't hurt my oil.
Then he hand breads them. And finally, his tenderloins are roasted, not fried.
We're going to put this in here, and I'm not going to tell you how long. We're not going to put them in something and let them soak in oil and get saturated with oil. We're going to put them in here, and instead of cooking from the outside in, we're going to cook them from the inside out.
And now for the moment of truth.
All right, here goes. Time for the taste test.
Yes, it is.
Oh my goodness.
It's like a better chicken nugget.
You'll have to excuse James. He's a vegetarian. Once you try their breaded pork tenderloin sandwich, it won't be a mystery why people keep going back. Namart and many of the local diners that specialize in breaded pork tenderloin sandwiches are places where people gather to enjoy the foods that define what it means to be a Hoosier.
Thanks to Betsy Shepherd and everyone at Traditional Arts Indiana for that report. Hear more from their second serving series at traditionalartsindiana.org. The Middleway House is a not-for-profit domestic violence shelter in downtown Bloomington, Indiana. That's what happens inside the walls. It's the cool things happening outside and on top of the building that we're interested in today. The perimeter of the building is being turned into edible landscaping by kids from a neighborhood school. And the roof is home to an expansive container garden. In the basement, there's worm composting and grow lights for parsley, cilantro, and rosemary. Our first stop today is the boiler room, which is consistently in the mid-70s. The plants love the warmth, apparently. Middleway House's maintenance coordinator is Eric Wainwright. In addition to all the growing that's happening, he's created a system of rain barrels on the roof that collects water from the building's many air conditioning units.
During the real humid weather last summer, we were getting a quart of water a minute, and that's usable water. So I set up a drain system that goes to the rain barrels to collect that as well.
Shall we go to the roof?
Yeah.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I think you'll like it.
It's a lot of space up here, I think.
Garden coordinators Andrea Job and Rika Macklin are in charge of maintaining the rooftop garden along with a slew of volunteers. They're growing herbs, tomatoes, peppers, and cabbage to sell to Foodworks, a catering company that actually shares the roof with them.
Yeah. Awesome. I like being up on top of the roof. I can get a different shot of the
nice
city.
And it's in a perfect location in Bloomington, right?
And the rain barrel's overflowing?
Yeah, we actually are getting them all moved over there, but they are all overflowing right now. As you can see, that one's leaking too. And it looks like we're going to get even more rain.
Yep.
As for the plants, most of them are growing in black plastic trays. But Job is especially excited about their other non-traditional planters.
What we're using here, anyway, are the kiddie pools. We also have some light fixtures that were donated from City Hall. You can also do containers and feed bags. So we're using old feed bags, maybe chicken food or dog food bags. You sew up an end, put some holes in it, and you can use that as a planter. I've also seen where they use bike helmets.
From the kiddie pools and the light fixtures to the standard trays, all the containers on the roof are shallow, maybe 6 inches deep at the most. The soil mixture is also lighter than what we'd use on the ground. This is all to make sure that there isn't too much weight produced by the garden.
You have to be very conscious of where the structural beams are located. And as you can imagine, water is very heavy. So not only the rain barrels, but once the containers are saturated with the water, then that's when things become the heaviest.
The gardeners also have to contend with wind gusts that are more intense than you find on the ground, where trees and buildings serve as protective barriers. But Job describes an even more unique challenge.
We were told that it's very, very possible that the roof might be a different climate zone than the grounds around. So, it is a black surfaced roof, meaning it is going to be absorbing a lot of the heat. So this can get really, really hot during the summer.
The roof is likely a climate zone higher than the ground 3 stories below. We'll come back down to earth in the second part of the show today to hang out with some fourth graders as they do weeding of blueberry bushes. Speaking of blueberries, our first recipe is for a summer berry grunt, which uses blueberries, blackberries, and raspberries.
So what we're going to do is we have a nice heavy bottom pan that we can also transfer to the oven if we choose later. We're going to add our sugar. We have about a cup of sugar. Okay, we're going to add a little bit of cinnamon. We have our flour, which add that again is going to be the thickener, and that's going to be about 3/4 of a cup. Okay, to this I'm going to add some earthy types of flavors. We have some ginger here. Again, we love to take old-fashioned recipes and update them. I'm adding some lemon thyme. We have some lemon zest. We're going to start stirring this together. Okay, you can see the flour starting to do its job. It's starting to thicken up. And we're going to cook this again until it starts to grunt. What that means is that the flour will start to absorb these flavors and start to bubble and spit at you a little bit. It's really a fast dish to make. So if you're in a hurry, it's much faster than even making a cobbler because you're making this filling right in the pan. Okay, there's several different ways you could finish it. You can finish it right on the stovetop by putting a cover on it and just letting it kind of steam there. Or you can take the whole thing and put it in the oven and bake it more like a traditional cobbler. Okay, now we're going to make the dumpling topping. So we've got our flour, sugar, a little baking powder. Okay, and to this we're going to add our butter. Okay, and we're going to mix the butter in until, just like if you're making a biscuit, until it starts to be about pea-sized pieces. Okay, and then we'll add the buttermilk. And we want this to be a fairly loose topping, so it'll be a little looser than a traditional biscuit dough. You see how it's getting nice and thick? Okay, I'm going to drop my little dumplings in here. And I'm going to go ahead and finish this in the oven. You can do it on the stovetop covered, and you'll have a nice moist dumpling where I like to get a little crisp on top. And I'm just going to take the whole dish back there and pop it in the oven. Today I'm going to be serving this with some Hoosier sweet corn ice cream. So it's a quick, fast, easy recipe. You can make whatever fruits in season, peaches, pears, apples. You can make a grunt just about of anything. So enjoy.
Check out the recipe and see a photo on our website where you can get plenty of other recipes for sweet treats. These days, our bloggers are especially excited about cooking with strawberries. Check it out at eartheats.org. Coming up,
we have 300 students who need outside time, who are interested in it, and we're interested in the science behind planting and sustainability and organics and all that kind of stuff. You can bring these kids out here, and it's like a living classroom.
We're back at the Middleway House, this time with Alicia Kropf and a group of kids from the Project School. They're getting their hands dirty pulling weeds. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop. And Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Indiana's State Board of Animal Health has launched a website where the public can share their opinions on whether raw milk should be sold in Indiana. It's all part of a summer study being conducted for the state legislature on what's at stake when it comes to legalizing the sale of raw milk. WFIU's Julie Raw has more.
It's breakfast time at the home of Tina Howard and her family, and something unusual is on the menu.
This is yogurt that we made last night. It's still warm right now.
Howard is pulling out the family's special supply of yogurt made with unpasteurized or raw milk, a product the family started drinking after their son had difficulty digesting store-bought milk. The Howards don't buy their milk because it's not legal to sell raw milk in Indiana. Instead, they get their milk through a cow-share arrangement. They own part of a cow with other families and then split the milk the cow produces with the other people. Howard says it's the only way they have access to raw milk, and if this option wasn't available, she doesn't know what they'd do.
Well, it's not an option to reverse the health effects by going back to the other milk that was causing all the problems to begin with. So we would either not drink it or we would figure out how to milk our own cow.
This summer, the State Board of Animal Health is studying the sale of raw milk, and based on research and public comment, the group will write a report recommending how the state should address the topic in next year's legislative session. Board of Animal Health spokesperson Denise Derer says having the public comment period could help generate ideas.
There's 27 states that allow the sale of raw milk in some form, and if you look at those laws of how they're written in other states, you'll find there's 27 different versions. So there is no good role model or standard out there necessarily. We're taking a hard look at all of those to see if there is something already in the pipeline, but we also want to think out of the box.
Derer says the comments won't be made public, but the Board of Animal Health will take the comments into consideration. As for Howard, she says she wishes there was a more straightforward way for her family to purchase the product.
You shouldn't have to feel like you have to maneuver through a black market to buy milk the way it comes out of a cow, when it comes out of a cow.
And many around the state agree that if some Hoosiers are obtaining and drinking unpasteurized milk anyway, there should be a better way to regulate the product. For WFIU News, I'm Julie Raw.
The Indiana State Board of Animal Health's website for public comment will remain open until September 1st. Find it at in.gov/BOAH. Back in the garden, we're moving from the roof at the Middleway House now to the land surrounding the building. Alicia Kropp from the Project School is getting ready to have a class of fourth graders join her for an hour of work in the garden.
When I'm looking at some squash or zucchini blossoms right here that are flourishing. These blossoms are gorgeous already.
Well, this was compost, so these were two compost bins. This just gives you an idea of the kind of work kids are doing.
Wait, this is a compost bin that's growing?
This is a compost bin, and these are volunteers. And we had a big compost pile here and a big compost pile there. So as a PE activity, we had the middle school come down and dig up the piles, move them all, and schlep over that bin. And then last week, all of this along this, the southern side of Middleway House, was all weeds. Like you can see down there, those are still weeds. I had my kindergartners, first graders come out, knock down all these weeds, and sheet mulch all of this. And then we put straw down, and then we planted it with the seedlings that they started in their classes.
The Project School includes kindergarten through eighth grade students, and all the kids get a chance to get their hands dirty. Through the support of two grants, they're helping turn the perimeter landscaping of the Middleway House into edibles that'll eventually be sold to Foodworks, a local catering company. Kropp explains that part of the educational experience is teaching kids where their food comes from, since Foodworks provides lunches for the Project School.
And the kids have been really jazzed by it. So for last week, when I had my first group of fourth graders who saw the blueberry bushes, we had an hour. And I thought, okay, we have an hour to weed these blueberries, right? They were done in about 20 minutes. I mean, these kids they had so much energy and they jumped on these blueberries. The weeds were flying. It was amazing.
So we will just wait now for the kids. We're sitting here in the garden. Here they come. Oh boy.
No, whiny.
Watch where you're walking. That's a garden right there. Don't walk on the straw. So we're going to work in the blueberries today. There's nine of you, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. All right, I'm going to give everybody a bush, and we're going to be deep weeding the blueberries. That means digging down under and getting the roots out, the weeds out at the roots.
Wait, I need the blackberry.
Oh, that's not a...
The blueberry bushes were planted as part of the renovations to turn the old Coca-Cola building into the new location for the Middleway House. But because of a lack of volunteer power, the bushes became overgrown with weeds. That's where nine sets of eager and energetic 10-year-old hands come in.
Yeah, we're digging up weeds so the weeds will not kill the blueberry plant.
So is this better than being inside in your class?
Yes,
totally.
What did you know about gardening before you came out here?
Not much. I mean, I helped my dad weed a little in our flower bed.
So let's talk about the fertilizer that you just threw on there. Tell me what's in the fertilizer.
I know there's this liquid stuff that looks like chocolate milk. It's called fish food. And then there's water. And then there's one other ingredient. It's very sticky.
Molasses, yeah.
Yes, molasses.
Okay, come on over here, Joelle.
Okay.
Let's mix up this fertilizer for you.
How much should I pour in?
You need to pour yourself 2 tablespoons. Can you do that yourself, or do you want me? Do you want me to?
Allow the chocolate milk.
Each bush gets a gallon of this food a week in order for the food to come out really nicely.
What are we doing tomorrow?
Tomorrow we're going to start plotting out how to net the blueberries.
Cool.
And we're also going to be planting some cover crops in the other gardens. We're going to be doing buckwheat.
Learn more about the gardens on top of and around the Middleway House and see photos on our website, eartheats.org. We're firing up the grill again this episode. Last week it was salmon. This week it's chicken. Chef Daniel Orr spent a couple of years working and cooking in Anguilla, so this dish is inspired by the flavors of the Caribbean.
It's interesting, in the Caribbean, they always start any chicken dish recipe by putting the chicken in a bowl and then washing it or rubbing it with lots of lime juice. You know, I think that it started out as being a way to help preserve the chicken with the acid from the lime, but now it just tastes like the Caribbean whenever you do something like that. Okay, and now we're going to add some different other flavors that we think of as Caribbean, some chilies. And this will use some jalapeno, seeds and all. I've got a little bit of like a curry powder. This is what I call mellow yellow, which is one of my personal spice blends. And I'm also going to add a little bit of cilantro. All right, we're also going to put just a little bit of dried herbs on it, some savory and some lavender and thyme and other herbs. Massage these herbs and spices into the chicken breast. All right, so we've got our chicken nice and marinated. And I also brought out some heirloom tomatoes. We're going to throw those on the grill, get them a little charred up.
So now tell me the secret of cooking the perfect chicken breast so that it's not dry.
First off, starting with a marinade like we did is really, really important. Then you want to, you don't want to keep flipping it over and back. You know, you want to just basically mark it on both sides and then turn your heat down and cook it slowly so you don't get it burnt. We're cooking the skin side first, marking it, cooking most of the fat out of it, and then we'll turn it over and cook the flesh side. Chicken, let's check it out. What I always like to do is to look between the tenderloin and the breast, and it should be cooked through. And whenever you roast something or grill something, it's best to let it rest a little bit, which means just to take it off the grill and let it sit before you serve it. It's what's called carryover cooking. And that means that exterior of the bird or whatever meat you're cooking is going to be hotter than the interior. So you're allowing that excess heat to penetrate into the meat and to make sure that it's cooked. And if you do that, you'll tend not to have a dry chicken. And get the margaritas going. It's time for a Caribbean chicken special.
Check out more recipes for jazzing up your boring grilled chicken on our website, eartheats.org.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh local organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop, and Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga, more at touchstonewellness.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
Be sure to tune in next week on Earth Eats when we'll speak with Matt Colglazier. He's developed a spirit made from local sorghum, so we'll taste test a couple of cocktails made with the stuff. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan. Happy eating, everyone.